What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Greetings, everybody. This is Charlie Robinson. We're going to get into the military tentacle of control. And the United States of America has actually been engaged in some form of war for 227 out of 244 years of existence. So that works out to about 93% of the time. The United States is in some form of war. There's only been 17 years that they haven't been. They haven't even gone a whole decade without being involved in some war. In fact, the only 5 year in a row period that they spent without being in war was from 1935 to 1940, and that was during what they call the isolationist period of the Great Depression. So the takeaway from this is that as long as America isn't totally broke, they're going to be involved in a war. And actually, even now, I'd say that a case could be made that we are broke and we're still in war. We're just putting it on our corporate American Express account. And it's obviously everything about that is a problem from the real life horrors of war to the displacement of people and what that means, the destruction of culture, the cost both on a human scale and on a financial scale. Surely we have better things to be spending our money on than bullets and bombs and things like that. But when you're run by the military-industrial complex and Raytheon and Boeing executives lobbying Congress for more money, then you're going to get what you get. You're going to get more war. You're going to get more fighting. James Madison, who was a former president of the United States, said no nation could preserve its freedoms in the midst of continual warfare. Well, I'm going to go ahead and file that under no shit. And we're currently watching that as we lose our freedoms every day. And because we're not even feeling the effects of the battlefield being in the United States. We're always the away team, playing road games with regard to war. We haven't had that happen on our soil yet. So even for us, it is hard to preserve our freedoms. Just think how difficult it is for people living in Iraq and Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia and all these places that, as George Carlin likes to say, the places where we drop bombs on brown people. He's right. That's our specialty. George McGovern, who was the former congressman in the United States, said, "I'm fed up to the ears with old men dreaming up wars for young men to die in." But that's what we get. you've got a bunch of military generals that are excited about having their war, and the military contractors are always concocting new reasons for us to go to war. We watched it in the 1950s with the Red Scare and everything about, you know, the threat of communism and Russia and all that. And part of that might have been true, but a huge component of it was also just the fear-mongering that created the military-industrial complex, the one that Eisenhower spoke about in 1961, warning about the undue influence. And so if you leave it up to people that have a financial incentive to profit from war, guess what? You're going to get more war. You're going to get endless war. And I would say that's what we have right now. You watch the – as Trump orders, you know, missile strikes in Iraq against some, you know, an Iranian general. And what happens? Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Boeing's stock go up from that. Well, maybe not Boeing. Boeing's got their own problems. But the other military industrial corporations, they benefit from that. And just think of the insanity, the psychosis of deciding that you need to drop bombs on people in foreign countries so that a stock will go up a couple dollars. I mean, it's insanity. But really, the middle of this century, the middle of you know, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, you know, what it proved to us is that when you put enough stress on human beings, they are no better than common apes. From the assembly line murder in Treblinka, the complete annihilation of Warsaw and Manila, to the horrific personalized firing squad extermination crews, Einsatzgruppen, terror bombing campaigns in Dresden and Tokyo, and chilling determination of kamikaze pilots in Leyte Gulf, the Bataan Death March of 100 miles with no water, unforgivable dropping of the atomic bomb. And it's, I think, a good case can be made that humanity took a couple steps backwards during World War II. It had to have been awful. My grandfather worked at Oak Ridge. He worked on the atomic bomb. He didn't know he was working on the atomic bomb. He had a 10th grade education. He wasn't a scientist or anything like that. But he'd been working on that Tennessee Valley Authority power plant in East Tennessee, which was tasked with creating a component of the bomb. And the only reason he didn't know what he was doing, showed up to work one day and everything was cleared out, gone. Had been moved to Los Alamos, and then from there it was finishing touches were put on the bombs, and then they were dropped on Japan. And he didn't feel pleasure. He didn't feel patriotism for that. He felt deceived, and he felt awful, and he felt like he had been a part of this, an unwilling and unknowing participant in something that created a nuclear bomb, an atomic bomb that wiped out 40,000 people in a instant. It's just, there's no winners in that. And it takes you back to that quote from Robert Oppenheimer, who developed the atomic bomb. He said, "We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed. A few people cried. Most people were silent. I remember the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, 'Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.' I suppose we all thought that in one way or another." In the 1960s, war was once again used to justify turning science against the people, this time in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam. You watch Dow Chemical spray Agent Orange over the jungle to defoliate all the trees so that you could see where the Viet Cong were hiding. And then napalm was dropped afterwards to finish off the job. in, you know, what 2200 degree napalm does to jungles and flesh was evident in that iconic picture of the naked Vietnamese girls running down the street with the whole village behind them and in flames from napalm. You know, congratulations, Dow Chemicals and Monsanto and, you know, all these corporations, they're still around. They're still doing this. They're still making weapons. And in your Monsanto's case, you're also making food. Think about how insane that is. So the sickness of all of this is that if you are a rational voice that stands up and speaks out against this, they label you as unpatriotic or a traitor, just like what they did to Muhammad Ali. He said, "Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs and denied simple human rights? No, I'm not going 10,000 miles from home to help murder and burn another poor nation simply to continue the domination of white slave masters of the darker people the world over. This is the day when such evils must come to an end. I've been warned that to take such a stand would cost me millions of dollars. But I've said it once and I will say it again. The real enemy of my people is here. I will not disgrace my religion, my people, or myself by becoming a tool to enslave those who are fighting for their own justice, freedom, and equality. If I thought the war was going to bring freedom and equality to 22 million of my people, they wouldn't have to draft me. I'd join tomorrow. I have nothing to lose by standing up for my beliefs, so I'll go to jail. So what? We've been in jail for 400 years. It's always money for war. If we took the money that the United States spends on their military and used that to solve the homeless crisis, we could give every homeless person in the United States $1 million home. Just think about that for a second. Of course, that's never going to happen because the homeless people do not have a voice. They don't have... There's not an economy behind them. There's not job. They don't create jobs. They don't generate revenue. They don't generate tax dollars. So they don't count as far as Congress is concerned. Oh, but the military industrial complex does. They make billions of dollars in profits and they pay taxes and they get no-bid government contracts and they get all of that stuff, which is why you get Raytheon lobbyists on MSNBC, CNN, and Fox coming on to explain to you all the reasons why we need to go to war. Never any sort of counterbalance to that, that we shouldn't, you know, we should mind our own business. That's isolationism is what they call it. You know, you can't have that. We have to be spreading democracy, liberating people. You know, all that stuff is bullshit. Whenever you hear somebody talking about spreading democracy, That's a code word for regime change and invasion, and we're never leaving. There's no democracy being spread. Spreading democracy by dropping bombs on people is an interesting way of doing it. I mean, I guess that's one way to look at it. But for anybody with a soul, you know, a rational brain, they hear that stuff and they know the code words. We're figuring that out. Nobody wants our democracy. I mean, especially considering we're having a hard time with it ourselves here in America. So maybe we should perfect it first at home before we take the initiative of forcing it upon the rest of the world. And even Paul Wolfowitz will admit that it's not about spreading democracy. He's a former president of the World Bank and also former U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense. He's one of those neocons that wrote the Project for a New American Century document. He said, "We did not go to war in Afghanistan or in Iraq to, quote, impose democracy. We went to war in both places because we saw those regimes as a threat to the United States." Well, I mean, finally, he's telling the truth about it. And, you know, the soldiers that are fighting, they're not fighting for freedom. or justice or some other vague concept that sounds good on the nightly news. They're fighting for the guys to their right and their left. They're fighting so that they can live for another day and go home and see their mother. You know, they are shooting the other people because they're afraid that the other people are going to be shooting at them. We put them in an impossible situation, then we criticize them for the things they have to do. Of course, some of them take it to extremes. We've seen some bad videos that were released by WikiLeaks, not just the collateral murder video from the Apache helicopter, but others. And so it's not to say that all the troops get a free pass on that. They certainly do not. They're responsible for their own conduct, but they are in a situation and a control structure through the military that makes it impossible for them to think for themselves. They're not incentivized to do that. They are instructed not to do that. They are instructed to follow orders. There's a huge debate about, you know, whether it's okay to just be following orders, to use that excuse. It didn't work in the Nuremberg trials. They said that following orders is not a good enough defense of that. But it's the dilemma that every soldier with a conscience faces while they're over there. You know, they're not over there lecturing the enemies with bullhorns or spreading democracy or whatever sort of, you know, nonsense the president is sowing. They're just trying to stay alive, and they're finding themselves in a really, really bad spot with only one way out, and that is through the barrel of a gun. You know, it's funny to hear sometimes. In the book, I quote a lot of the Nazi officers, not because I want to glorify them, but because from time to time, you'll find them talking about things in a very truthful way, very matter of fact. They felt that they would win the war, and they knew that if they won the war, then there would be no checks on them. And so they could basically say what they wanted or do what they wanted without any sort of repercussions, because in their mind, there was no chance they were going to lose. So every now and then you get them speaking the truth. And this is from Goebbels, who is the minister of propaganda for the Third Reich. He said, "Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia, nor in England, nor in America, nor for that matter in Germany. That is understood. But the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in every country." I think it's interesting to note that back during World War II, the Department of Defense was actually named something different. It was called the Department of War, which is obviously a more accurate title for them. Something happened, though, after the 40s. It looks like Madison Avenue gave them a makeover because they changed the name to the Department of Defense. It's funny. Once they changed the name to the Department of Defense, there wasn't a whole lot of defense going on. It was the Department of Offense, as far as I'm concerned. And you see that, once again, not just with the Nazis that every now and then have an unhonest conversation on the record about something, but we see that in our own government as well. I think a lot of people have heard the quote, the interview that General Wesley Clark did on Democracy Now! Talking about the invasion. I'm going to read this, because it's very important to understand not just the direction that we're headed. This was recorded in 2007, I think. But not just, you know, where we're headed, but that all of these wars, they're not accidental. They're not impulsive. They've been planned far in advance. So this is what he said. "About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon, and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me in. He said, 'Sir, you got to come in and talk to me a second.' I said, 'Well, you're too busy.' He said, 'No, no.' He says, 'We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq.' This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, we're going to war with Iraq. Why? He said, I don't know. He said, I guess they don't know what else to do. So I said, well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda? He said, no, no. He says, there's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq. He said, I guess it's like, we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's much worse than that. He reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office, today. And he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran. Wow. Okay. What do you think about that list? That's when he was talking about this in 2007, but the list was from 2001. How have we done? Iraq? Yeah. Syria? Yeah. Lebanon? I don't know. Libya? Yeah. Somalia? Uh-huh. Sudan? I don't know about that. Finishing off with Iran? We're definitely pushing for finishing off with Iran. I mean, this is insanity. And people, I was never in the military. I can't pretend to know what it would be like in war. I'm just a writer. And but I'll tell you someone who does know what it's like to be in war as a writer, and that's Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He's been arrested multiple times for protesting. He brought a lawsuit against the Obama administration for unlawful surveillance. He teaches in prisons in Princeton, New Jersey. He's a badass. He's written a lot of books, and he was stationed in the Middle East. He speaks, Arabic perfectly, and he's witnessed the wars there. He was also in Bosnia during the war in the late 90s. And this is from a book he wrote called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. In the beginning, war looks and feels like love, but unlike love, it gives nothing in return, but an ever-deepening dependence, like all narcotics, on the road to self-destruction. It does not affirm, but places upon us greater and greater demands. It destroys the outside world until it is hard to live outside war's grip. It takes a higher and higher dose to achieve any thrill. Finally, one ingests war only to remain numb. So if you're going into a war, you're one of these soldiers sitting on a C-130 flying in, shitting themselves, wondering if they're about to be killed. What do you wish for? Do you wish for strength? Do you want courage? Do you want your God to forgive you? Do you want wisdom or bravery? What do you want? Tell you what I'd pick. I'd just pick luck. Just random, good old-fashioned luck. It seems like everybody that's been in combat has one story that relates to just being lucky. A lady I know whose son was in Afghanistan was on a patrol, was marching, and they heard an inbound mortar shell coming, and it landed about 10 yards in front of him. It didn't explode. And he made the mistake of telling his mother that when he got back. And of course, he lived. It didn't go off. It was a dud. What does that do to your life? I mean, how do you should be dead. Everybody around you should be dead. And it's like playing with house money from that point on. Every single thing that happens in your life, every good thing, every bad thing, is bonus because you shouldn't be experiencing that. What does that do to you? What does that do to your soul? Does it make you a better person, worse person, indifferent, cynical? I think it messed him up. If I remember the story correctly. But this is the reality of it. We get the sanitized version on our nightly news. We don't hear about that because that's a bummer. We don't want to hear about the guys getting shot on RT. We only want to hear about how we're doing, you know, are we winning? We're winning. We're winning the hearts and minds. Get the fuck out of here with that hearts and minds stuff. Nobody's winning hearts and minds by bombing those people. You know, there's no moral victory. There's no victory of any kind there. We're destroying other countries with a big red, white, and blue flag waving. And what? For what? Going into Iraq and Afghanistan. Got to go into Afghanistan, get them terrorists, you know, those terrorists that were on the planes that flew into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and Shanksville and all that stuff. Oh, you mean all those Saudis? The 15 out of the 19 Saudi hijackers? That is, if there were even hijackers on the planes? Come on. This is ridiculous. What are we going to do? Bomb Afghanistan back to the Stone Age? They were in the Bronze Age on September 10th. Where did that take us? An afternoon to do that? It's crazy. $1 trillion flushed down the toilet. International goodwill totally evaporated. And for what? So the CIA can manage the poppy fields in Afghanistan? Mine the place for lithium and other sorts of metals and topaz and lapis and all those emeralds and all the things you get out of them. I mean, this is, congratulations, United States. This is the worst investment we ever made, financially, emotionally, as far as our reputation around the world, you know. Chris Hedges was there, you know, he saw that firsthand. He was there with snipers in Bosnia shooting at him. Not the imaginary ones that Hillary Clinton talked about when she was landing and, you know, at the airport there. He saw the real ones. He said this: war is always about betrayal. It's about the betrayal of the young by the old, of the cynics by the idealists, of soldiers and Marines by politicians, a duplicity of our institutions, including our religious institutions, which mold us into compliant citizens, are unmasked by war. And this betrayal is so deep that many who return from war never find their way back to faith in the nation or in any God. And who can blame them? They nurse a self-destructive anger and resentment, understandable and justified, but also crippling. Ask a combat veteran struggling to pieces or her life back together about God and watch the raw vitriol and pain pour out. They have seen into the corrupt heart of America. They have grasped our staggering hypocrisy. The battle being fought today is a battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. It is a battle between the sacred and profane, between good and evil, between those who stand up for the sanctity of life and those who deny life. And this battle, which predated our existence and will continue long after we are gone, is what defines and sustains the moral life. It is what gives us meaning and hope. It is what makes a life worth living. In World War II, the SS were a bunch of ruthless psychopaths that reveled in their reputation as cold-blooded killers. But they only had that reputation because word spread about how vicious they were, which means that they didn't kill everybody that they dealt with. There were witnesses that saw what the SS did and lived to tell about it. And that was intentional. There was a reason for that on the part of the Germans. And that was because they wanted the world to know that they were the worst of the worst. They wanted the countries to fear them. But what the world wasn't aware of was that there was another group of Germans that made the SS look like a bunch of Boy Scouts. And these soldiers were actually not feared by the villagers because anybody that ever came in contact with them didn't live to tell about it. If you were in some village in Poland, and you came in contact with the Einsatzgruppe, and you were dead. That's just the way it was. They killed everybody. What they did was they created four groups of this, of the Einsatzgruppe, to control the populations. Each of the groups were made up with about a little like 1,100 or so soldiers. And they came through the cities after the Blitzkrieg rolled through and after the SS had taken out the opposing soldiers. The citizens that were left after the fighting, they were separated with the Jews taken away somewhere nearby, usually to like a ravine or a canyon or a pit or a ditch somewhere. Forced to remove their jackets, put them all in a pile, take off their clothes, put them in another pile, take off their shoes, tie the laces together because it would be easier, you know, if you kept the shoes together. They would be taken to the edge of a ravine, lined up, and shot in the head. Men, women, children. What they said was that they always shot the mothers before they shot the children, because they knew that it would be hard for the mothers to see them shoot the children. Isn't that nice? Isn't that thoughtful of them? There's a line in the movie, The Thin Red Line, and this is the actor Jim Caviezel plays this role of Private Edward Train. He's kind of the main character in it. And it's towards the end of the movie, and he's looking back on everything, and he says, "This great evil, where's it come from? How'd it steal into this world? What seed, what root did it grow from? Who's doing this? Who's killing us, robbing us of light and life, mocking us with a sight of what we might have known? Does our ruin benefit the earth? Does it help the grass to grow, the sun to shine? Is this darkness in you too? Have you passed through this night?" It's a sad movie. The Einsatzgruppe were issued double the normal ration of alcohol because they were having such a hard time dealing with what they were doing. You know, they would roll into cities, population levels of 40,000, and these guys might kill a dozen people per day. You know, they were losing their minds. They were, and it was taking a psychological toll on them for what they were doing. You know, nobody was immune to that. And it actually led to the creation of the concentration camps, because Heinrich Himmler came by one time to witness the Einsatzgruppe, and you know, they were performing mop-up duty on a town, and during the shooting, Himmler got blood on himself and started to throw up from it in front of the men, and you know, because he didn't have the stomach for it. Real tough guy, you know, ordering the murders, but can't stand to do it himself or be around it. And after that, that's when they made the decision to actually one of the German officers that was dealing with all of this had got himself drunk and passed out in his car in a garage while the car was running, and damn near killed himself. And actually, they decided, this carbon monoxide gas might be a good way to actually get rid of these people instead of shooting them. And so they experimented with hooking up the exhaust pipes of vans and things like that into these small rooms and using the carbon monoxide to kill the people. Not because they had any sort of empathy for the people they were killing, but the fact that the bullets were very expensive and they needed to ration them and make sure they held on to them was part of the reason why they were pushed into this development of new and ingenious ways of killing people. Gotta love the pragmatic Germans. They're always thinking. Let's take a break from the show just for a minute so I can tell you about our sponsors, Scribd. If you are into audiobooks or
ebooks or magazines or anything, you have got to get this service. It's $9.99 a month. You can join free for 30 days and cancel whenever you want. You have unlimited access to thousands of books. You got books on conspiracies, books on UFOs, JFK, Bigfoot, whatever you're into, they've got them there, not to mention all the magazines. It's 33% cheaper than Audible. You got access to more books, for audiobooks from major publishers. They're unlimited. You can listen to or read as much as you want. The link for Scribd is in the description box below. Anything that you sign up for with them helps to benefit the show, and we certainly do appreciate that. And if you're into ebooks and audiobooks like I am, then you're probably also into documentaries. And CuriosityStream is our other sponsor. They have thousands of documentaries. They're award-winning, they're exclusives, they have originals. You can watch them anytime you want, anywhere you want. High definition quality, unlimited streaming of thousands of shows. You can stream it on your laptop, your TV, your phone, your tablet. You can even watch it offline if you want. Yearly subscription, $19.99. If you break it down to a month, they've got it for $2.99 a month. That's nothing. If you like it in high definition 4K, they also have that available for a little bit more. So the link to CuriosityStream is also in the description box. Take a look. Sign up for these services if you like them and you stick with them. Our show benefits from it. We certainly do appreciate that. I like these two sponsors a great deal because they're both in the business of providing us with additional information from a variety of sources. And you've got to love that. Thank you so much for supporting my show, and thanks for supporting the sponsors as well. As the United States moved into the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, they took on a new project that came straight from the top, and it was called enhanced interrogation. It's waterboarding, right? A form of torture. And what they would do is they would capture Taliban leaders and Al-Qaeda soldiers, load them onto a plane, and quietly fly them to the United States' worst-kept secret, which was Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. And this was obviously a huge embarrassment for the United States once it was disclosed that what was happening there. I remember when Obama came into office, he pledged that he was going to shut down the prison as soon as he took office. Well, we're still waiting. It's bigger than ever. It's still operational. But one of the things that the CIA was running these torture programs under the guidance of Gina Haspel back then. She, before she became CIA director, she was just a regular run-of-the-mill psychopath who was in charge of the interrogation there. And some of the songs that they would use, they would play them on a loop in the soldiers or in the prisoners' jail cells, blasting it to 11, you know. These were the songs that they would play. And I think if you hear them, you might understand why you might reasonably go out of your fucking mind listening to this. Raspberry Beret by Prince. We're Coming to America by Neil Diamond. Barney's theme song. Beautiful People by Marilyn Manson. And the Meow Mix commercial song with the cat singing. I mean, this isn't a joke. This is 100% serious. Can you imagine hearing the Meow Mix song like on a permanent loop in a prison cell for 4 days straight, which is what they were doing? I mean, I'm trying not to laugh. I mean, it's obviously not funny, but I mean, just the idea of it is insane. I mean, these poor bastards would probably try to hang themselves with anything they could get their hands on. That is after confessing to being the guy that installed the faulty O-ring on the Space Shuttle Challenger, after confessing to sinking the Titanic and for interfering with Moises Alou trying to catch a foul ball at Wrigley Field back in 2003, the Steve Bartman thing. It wasn't Steve Bartman, it was me. God damn it. I did it. I admit it. Just let me go. I mean,
if you want to hate the CIA, there's a lot of reasons, but Jesus Christ, man, the way they treated these people, who had not been convicted of anything, by the way, and were in some cases literally ratted out by people that they were associates with. So in Afghanistan, you might be a guy that has a beef with some guy in your village. All you had to do was go to the Americans and say, that guy is working with the Taliban. And they would round that guy up, no judge, no jury, no evidence, no nothing. Take him, throw him in an airplane with a bunch of other guys that had been ratted out probably by people that had problems with them. And shipped off to Guantanamo Bay to be tortured forever because they're allowed to hold them indefinitely until the war is over. Well, if it's an endless war, then you can hold them indefinitely. And that's exactly what happened, which is a stain and embarrassment on America. And it just shows how hypocritical America's foreign policy is. And we talk about terrorists, you know, the terrorists that are doing these unspeakable things while we're doing things that are much worse than the terrorists ever did. In fact, I think a very strong case can be made that they aren't terrorists. They're people that are defending themselves. I mean, after all, the United States invaded Afghanistan and Iraq on a bunch of lies. What do you expect them to do? Just give up and shoot themselves? I mean, that's not in their culture. They're going to fight. They're going to fight back. But we just brand them as being terrorists, enemy combatants, and things like that. Of course, they're enemy combatants. Of course, what do you want them to do? Just lay down? It's not going to happen. That's not how they operate. That's why they've been around for thousands of years, herding goats and doing the things that they do, and why the Russians couldn't beat them back in the 80s, because these are people that that do not fuck around. They will fight you to the death. And what we've done in there is brand everybody as being terrorists. We don't understand their culture. We don't understand how things work there, that they switch sides from one team to the other all the time, and that's a normal thing for them to do. And we could never understand that. That's part of the reason why we couldn't, quote, win in Afghanistan, because it's a very unique culture there, one that the Western mind has a hard time truly understanding. There's a guy named Mike Preisner who is a American soldier. Now he's Abby Martin's partner, but boyfriend, and also film producing partner. He had a really great speech that he gave. It's a little long, but I'm going to read it because it's worth reading. This is after he came back from service in Iraq and Afghanistan. I tried hard to be proud of my service, but all I could feel was shame, and racism can no longer mask the operation. These were people. These were human beings. I've since been plagued by guilt every time I see an elderly man, like the one who couldn't walk, so we rolled him onto a stretcher and told the Iraqi police to take him away. I feel guilty every time I see a mother with her children, like the one who cried hysterically and screamed that we were worse than Saddam, as we forced her from her home. I feel guilt every time I see a young girl, like the one I grabbed by the arm and dragged into the street. We are told that we are fighting terrorists, but the real terrorist was me. And the real terrorism was this occupation. Racism in the military has long been a tool to justify the destruction and occupation of another country. It has long been used to justify the killing, occupation, and torture of another people. Racism is a vital weapon employed by this government. It is a more important weapon than a rifle, a tank, a bomber, or a battleship. It is more destructive than an artillery shell, a bunker buster, or a tomahawk missile. While all those weapons are created by this government, they are harmless without the people to use them. Those who send us to war do not have to pull the trigger or lob a mortar round. They don't have to fight the war. They merely have to sell the war. They need a public that is willing to send their soldiers into harm's way. They need soldiers willing to kill and be killed without question. They can spend millions on a single bomb, but that bomb only becomes a weapon when the ranks in the military are willing to follow orders to use it. They can send every last soldier anywhere on Earth, but there will only be a war if soldiers are willing to fight. And the billionaires, the ruling class that profit from human suffering, care only about expanding their wealth, controlling the world's economy, understand that their power lies only in their ability to convince us that war, oppression, and exploitation are in our interests. They understand that their wealth is dependent on their ability to convince the working class to die, to control the wealth of another country. And convincing us to kill and die is based on their ability to make us feel that we are somehow superior. Soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen have nothing to gain from this occupation. The vast majority of people living in the U.S. have nothing to gain from this occupation. In fact, not only do we have nothing to gain, but we suffer more because of it. We lose limbs, endure trauma, and lose our lives. Our families have to watch flag-draped coffins lowered into the earth. Millions in this country without health care, jobs, or access to education must watch this government squander $450 million a day on this occupation. Poor and working people in this country are sent to kill poor and working people in another country to make the rich richer. Without racism, soldiers would realize they have more in common with the Iraqi people than with the billionaires that send us to war. I threw families onto the street in Iraq, only to come home and see families thrown to the streets in this country in this tragic and unnecessary foreclosure crisis. To wake up and realize that our real enemies are not in some distant land whose names we don't know and cultures we don't understand. The enemy is people that we know very well and people that we can identify. The enemy is a system that wages war when it's profitable. The enemy is the CEOs who lay us off our jobs when it's profitable. It's the insurance companies who deny us health care when it's profitable. It's the banks who take away our homes when it's profitable. Our enemy is not 5,000 miles away. They are right here at home. If we organize with our sisters and brothers, we can stop this war, we can stop this government, and we can create a better world. That's a really insightful analysis of war from somebody that's been there. And Mike and Abby have done some really great documentaries. They've done one about Gaza. And they've really turned into activists in their own right. You know, and he was talking, this was, you know, a quote that he made in, I think, 2009 or 10. And the war's still going on. You know, it hasn't stopped. In fact, in 2016, the American military dropped 26,171 bombs on a variety of countries. That works out to 72 bombs every single day. But the Russians are the problem, right? Right? They're the ones we have to worry about. The president doesn't even have the authority to drop these 26,000 bombs on any of these countries. They haven't issued a declaration of war from Congress on this. It's illegal. These are illegal bombings. I'm going to talk about war crimes and terrorists. I mean, you don't need to look very further than Congress and the White House and the top branches of the military. Those are the war criminals. Those are the terrorists. They fit the definition. Wars are very useful for making major changes to a society because the fog of war hides the true intent of those in positions of powers. Restrictions are implemented, regulations are lifted. If the politicians are able to convince the people that these changes are being made to protect them, and they can convince everyone that any opposition to these new rules is unpatriotic, then there's like an almost unlimited number of changes that can be forced on the people, onto their society. The people that are controlling this government in the United States have got this down to a science. Just look at the Patriot Act. You know, they always give it these really interesting names that are the exact opposite of what they're really doing. The Patriot Act. Oh, we're going to protect you. We're going to, this is a patriotic act. It did, what it did was remove Americans' rights, randomly labeled people as terrorists. It was the precursor to things like the Department of Homeland Security, TSA, those morons in the blue and black at the airport that grab your nuts every time you try and go get on an airplane. These things did not exist before 9/11. Kids that have grown up in this new era, post 2000 and on, they see this as normal. They don't know a world without them. But it's not normal. This was all instituted after 9/11. And 9/11, of course, was the biggest deception ever perpetrated on the American people. And once you know that, then you look at all the rules and regulations, the restrictions of freedom and spying programs that were put into place, not to spy on everybody else, but to spy on us as Americans. And so you have to take that back to its base where it started. It started after 9/11, and 9/11 was, of course, a gigantic lie. So all of these restrictions and rules and limits to our freedom and removal of privacy and all of that is unwarranted. It's unnecessary because the event that triggered it itself was not as it appeared to be. It was not conducted by 19 Arab hijackers with box cutters. It's a preposterous story. None of it is true. It's all a lie. It's a gigantic lie. And therefore, everything that came as a result of that lie should be invalidated. But, you know, good luck trying to explain that to people. The maniacs that run this world now are some of the same maniacs that ran the world back in the 60s and 70s. Look at Henry Kissinger as an example. The 9/11 Commission, the first person that they tried, that W. Bush tried to put in there to run the 9/11 Commission was Henry Kissinger. People flipped out on that, and rightfully so. He's a reprehensible human being. Well, I don't even know if he's a human being. He's definitely a reptilian of some sort. I mean, he looks like a gigantic frog. I've never seen a guy that's almost 100 years old as fat as that. There's got to be something going on there. Don't old people get skinny? What's wrong with that guy? Well, anyway, Henry Kissinger said in 1973, "The illegal we do immediately. The unconstitutional takes a little longer." Oops. Giving the game away a little bit there, are you, Heinrich? He's the greatest war criminal alive today, in my opinion. I think that Henry Kissinger should die in a prison cell somewhere. I think everybody that understands Henry Kissinger feels that way. Actually, George Galloway said this. He's a former MP from the UK. He said, "Henry Kissinger is the greatest living war criminal in the world today. With the blood of millions of people in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and Chile and East Timor on his hands, he will never appear in a court or be behind bars." You want to know something interesting about Vietnam? The bombings. You know, we see these World War II documentaries that show all the bombing of Dresden and Berlin and Manila and Warsaw and all these cities that were leveled by countless never-ending bombing, it seems. But if you take all of the bombs that Germany dropped on Poland, Ukraine, Hungary, France, Russia, Finland, Netherlands, Lithuania, Crimea, Azerbaijan, Yugoslavia, North Africa, Denmark, Estonia, Latvia, and England, then you add all the bombs that America dropped on the Germans in France, then on the Germans in Germany, on Italy and Okinawa, Iwo Jima, Tarawa, and Japan, then count all the bombs that Japan dropped on Pearl Harbor, several islands in the Philippines, China, Papua New Guinea, Okinawa, Saipan, and all the other islands, all the little islands in the South Pacific, and calculate all the bombs the British dropped on Germany, on the German-controlled areas of Western Europe, plus the bombs that Russia dropped on Germany, and the bombs that Russia dropped on all the Eastern Bloc countries, I had all of these bombs together from all the countries throughout the entire conflict of World War II from 1939 to 1945. Multiply that by two, and that's the number of bombs that the United States dropped on Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. Think about that for a while. That's insane. We saw little bits of that. We see little Vietnam documentary clips where they show them bombing. But we had no idea how many bombs were actually dropped. In fact, in Afghanistan, in 2016, Afghanistan and Iraq, we actually ran out of bombs to drop. There were no more bombs. We had to make more. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that nice of us? I mean, you got to be thrilled if you're some executive at Raytheon who gets to build more bombs and sell them and watch their stock price go up. But this is the madness of war. This is the insanity that we've accepted as normal. What's normal about this? This is crazy. This is Henry Kissinger. Military men are just dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns in foreign policy. I mean, what a prick, huh? Oh, by the way, he won the Nobel Peace Prize, 1973. You know who else won that? Barack Obama. And I suppose that he wore his Nobel Peace Prize around his neck as he was ordering the drone bombings of seven different countries in the Middle East. This level of hypocrisy is common and normal, unfortunately, in America. And yet, if you don't tie that yellow ribbon around that tree tightly enough and put your hand over your heart and say, pledge allegiance to the flag enough, then you're a fucking traitor, right? That's what they'll have you believe. Well, guess what? I don't love titles. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not any of those things. But there's one title that I am proud to associate with. I'm anti-war. I don't like it. We don't need it. It's horrible for our souls. It's horrible for our countries. It's horrible for this planet. But you get guys like Henry Kissinger, who has no soul at all, and you put them in charge of foreign policy, what do you think you're going to get? Here's a quote from Henry Kissinger. How many people did Khmer Rouge Foreign Minister Ieng Sary kill? Tens of thousands? You should tell the Cambodians, meaning Khmer Rouge, that we will be friends with them. They are murderous thugs, but we won't let that stand in the way. We are prepared to improve relations with them. Tell them the latter part, but don't tell them what I said before. What a fucking asshole he is. But there is one thing you can say about Henry Kissinger, and that is from time to time he is honest about his intentions. He said in 1991 to the Bilderberg Organization, this is clearly not meant to be a speech that is relayed to the general public, but he said, today Americans would be outraged if United Nations troops entered Los Angeles to restore order. Tomorrow they will be grateful. This is especially true if they were told there was an outside threat from beyond, whether real or promulgated, that threatened our very existence. It is then that all people of the world will pledge with world leaders to deliver them from this evil. The one thing every man fears is the unknown. When presented with this scenario, individual rights will willingly be relinquished for the guarantee of their well-being granted to them by their world government. So he's the guy that talks about the need for world government, the new world order, all that stuff. We're not imagining this. When you talk about the march towards a one world government, he even mentioned it in there. He said Americans would be outraged if United Nations troops entered Los Angeles. He's telling you, the United Nations is the organization created by the Rockefellers that will be managing the transition to a one world government. That's their job. That's their role. They're United Nations. I guess technically they are uniting nations together. Their plan is to unite them all into one gigantic government with a world, you know, one world order with a world army. But if you've got just a one world government and a one world army, then who does that army fight against? I think the answer is that it fights against the people. And this is why so many people are opposed to the United Nations Agenda 2030. It used to be Agenda 2021, which was the push for, you know, anything in the 21st century. But then they had to move the goalposts back to 2030 because they didn't have it all wrapped up by then. But Agenda 2030 is most definitely a push towards this new world order, one world government. They're using the United Nations as the organization that's going to do that. And that's Henry Kissinger's, that's his group. This is who he's with. This is who he's talking about this at Bilderberg, like it's a, you know, like it's a normal thing. This was 1991. Well, what happened 10 years later? We had 9/11. I mean, let's look back on what Henry Kissinger was talking about. If there was an outside threat from beyond, whether real or promulgated, that threatened our very existence. You mean like Arab terrorists and hijackers? That sort of thing? If you were to grab Henry Kissinger and waterboard that guy, you'd find out a lot of really useful information about who is behind some of these false flag attacks. And the United Nations is involved in this for sure, among others, including the United States government, the Israeli government, the Saudi royal family, and the British government. They're all involved in 9/11. You dig into the details of that. That's not conspiracy theorist talk. That's looking at the evidence. It's there. And the guys that sell you this are guys like Kissinger. And Christopher Hitchens said, he's an author, he wrote a book called The Trial of Henry Kissinger, and he's had this to say about Kissinger. He said, "Kissinger should have the door shut in his face by every decent person and should be shamed, ostracized, and excluded. No more dinners in his honor, no more respectful audiences for his absurdly overpriced public appearances, no more smirking photographs with hostesses and celebrities, no more soliciting of his worthless opinions by sycophantic editors and producers." I agree with that. You know, Henry Kissinger said that he thinks that the world population should be reduced by 50%. I say, you know what? That sounds like a good idea, Henry. Why don't we start by cutting you in half? See how that is. See how that goes. They always want to reduce the population. Ted Turner says, you know, we got to get the population down from 7 billion down to 2 billion. What's funny, he's got 5 grandkids. Which one of those grandkids gets to live and which ones do you suggest we should get rid of there, Ted? You know, this hypocrisy of reducing the population. It always is other – they always want to reduce everybody else, right? They never want to reduce their own batch of people. In fact, you know, Bernie Sanders had something similar to say about Henry Kissinger. He said, "I happen to believe that Henry Kissinger was one of the most destructive secretaries of state in modern history of this country. I am proud to say that Henry Kissinger is not my friend. I will not take advice from Henry Kissinger. And in fact, Kissinger's actions in Cambodia when the United States bombed that country, overthrew Prince Sihanouk, created the instability for Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge to come in, who then butchered some 3 million innocent people. It was one of the worst genocides in the history of the world. So count me in as somebody who will not be listening to Henry Kissinger." Well, you know what? You can count me in on that as well. Henry Kissinger did not invent warfare. The Nazis and the Einsatzgruppen did not invent the murder of innocent people. The United States did not invent the concept of bombing foreign countries on dubious intelligence information. All of these people are part of the problem. They're not the only part, but they're one part of it. And we're going to get into more of that, about who else was involved, who from the United States government had a hand in some of these unspeakable actions. There's going to be a lot of names that you recognize, definitely starting with the Bushes, but not limited to them. But I will end this episode with a quote from George H.W. Bush, one of the worst human beings to ever live. And he said to journalist Sarah McClendon back in 1992, "If the American people ever find out what we have done, they would chase us down the street and lynch us."